Today is Monday, January 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Speaking on ABC's This Week, Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says U.S. President Donald Trump needs to face consequences.
Would we say that there should be absolutely no response to that? No. It is an act of insurrection.
But what's the legal threshold?
What we mean by an insurrection is a violent uprising against the established government.
Plus, an update on the deadly Indonesian jet crash this weekend. We'll have these stories and more next. As more Democrats call for a second impeachment of U.S. President Donald Trump, more Republicans are saying they don't want to see him serve out the final days of his term either. AP correspondent Ben Thomas starts us off.
Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania has joined Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski in calling for President Trump to resign and go away as soon as possible. While on ABC's This Week, Congressman Adam Kinzinger says,
I think the best thing for the country to heal would be for him to resign. The next best thing is the 25th Amendment, and that's why I call on Vice President Pence to do it.
But as for impeachment,
I honestly don't think impeachment's the smart move because I think it victimizes Donald Trump.
Still, Kinzinger says if it comes to impeachment,
I'll vote the right way when it's when, you know, whatever's put in front of me.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
In an interview with ABC's This Week, Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says President Trump needs to face consequences.
If another head of state came in and ordered an attack on the United States Congress, would we say that that should not be prosecuted? Would we say that there should be absolutely no response to that? No. It is an act of insurrection.
No decision has been made, but House Speaker Nancy Pelosi could introduce an impeachment resolution Monday, accusing Trump of inciting an insurrection in a futile effort to block Congress from certifying the Electoral College vote in favor of President-elect Joe Biden. President-elect Biden has taken a hands-off stance on the impeachment move against the president, who has yet to concede the election, even though Trump has acknowledged that there will be a, quote, new administration in Washington come January 20th. Federal agents have arrested two more Capitol Hill rioters whose images had gone viral. One man was seen in a photograph carrying off the House Speaker's lectern, and another was pictured wearing horns and a fur pelt. A top Democratic lawmaker called on mobile carriers to preserve social media content related to the assault. Dozens of people have been charged following the storming of the Capitol on Wednesday, with the FBI asking the public to help identify participants, given the proliferation of images of the riots on the internet. Five people died because of the riot, including a police officer. As law enforcement continues to arrest those responsible for breaching the U.S. Capitol, terms like rioting, sedition, and insurrection have been used by some critics to describe their actions. To better understand the legal definitions of these terms, I spoke with Joel Paul, a constitutional law professor at the University of California, Hastings.
Sedition is basically the crime of inciting someone to commit insurrection. And what we mean by an insurrection is a violent uprising against the established government. This conspiracy would be conspiring to prevent the execution of any law of the United States or to seize U.S. government property by force, which in fact happened. The crime of insurrection, which under the federal law provides that anyone who incites or engages in a rebellion or insurrection against the laws of the United States or the authority of the United States or gives comfort or aid to people who engage in insurrection are subject to criminal penalty. And in that case, the criminal penalty includes being disqualified from ever holding office again.
And what about the term riot? Because some have called what happened on Wednesday a protest, while law enforcement has labeled it a riot. So what is the legal threshold?
Well, any kind of a violent public disturbance can constitute a riot. And a riot could be against an individual. It could be against property, either public or private property. It isn't necessarily aimed at a political purpose or against the authority of the United States government. So those individuals who burned stores or attacked police cars or policemen during the otherwise peaceful demonstrations may be guilty of engaging in a riot. And that would be a violation both of federal law and also a violation of the laws of the District of Columbia. So at a minimum, the people who engaged in the violent attack on the Capitol are guilty of violating the laws of the District of Columbia, and they can be imprisoned for up to 10 years for that. And a person who incites someone to riot can also be imprisoned for up to 10 years.
Thank you for that. I want to switch gears for just a second here. Democrats have called on President Trump to either resign or for Vice President Mike Pence and a majority of the cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove President Trump from office. Barring those two things, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has indicated that she will bring forward articles of impeachment on Monday and then hand those over to the Senate, where a trial to remove the president would then take place. However, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has stated that because the Senate is in a pro forma session, meaning not meeting until January 19th, that any articles brought forward would not be discussed until the earliest January 19th, a day before President-elect Biden's inauguration. As a constitutional legal expert, is that a correct interpretation of the outline in the Constitution?
Well, it's a correct reading of the rules, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the president could be impeached even after he leaves office. I mean, he could be convicted, rather, for the crime after he leaves office. So it is possible that the president could be impeached before he leaves office and then convicted after he leaves office. And the significance of the conviction after he leaves office would not simply be historical, setting a precedent and making it clear that what the president did was unconstitutional and a violation of his duties as president. But it would also bar him from ever seeking or holding federal office in the future.
And another aspect of this is, aside from voting a president out of office, invoking the 25th Amendment, and impeaching and then removing a president through that mechanism, are there any other constitutional ways for a president to be removed from office?
Well, potentially a constitutional way to have him removed from office, yes. The 14th Amendment, Section 3, prohibits a person from serving in federal or state office if they have engaged in insurrection against the United States. A court could potentially issue an order saying that the president is hereby removed and it's in violation of the 14th Amendment's literal language for him to remain in office. The problem with that is basically a problem of civil procedure. It's difficult to get into court unless you have standing, and I don't know who might have standing to do that.
Joel Paul is a constitutional law expert and teaches at UC Hastings College of the Law. The far-right-friendly social media app Parler risks going offline after Amazon has decided to boot it off its web hosting services. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
A lot of social media activity leading up to Wednesday's violent takeover of the U.S. Capitol was posted on Parler. And after that, there were boasts of the out-of-control scene that left five people dead, including a police officer. Google and Apple both removed it from their app stores, with Amazon promising to stop hosting it. Parler's CEO said that could knock it offline for a week as the app searches for a new host. President Trump, who has been banned from Twitter, says he may launch his own platform, but that won't happen overnight. Meanwhile, free speech experts anticipate growing pressure on all social media platforms to curb incendiary speech as Americans take stock of what happened Wednesday. I'm Julie Walker.
President Trump's unsubstantiated insistence that he won the election, his recorded attempt to push Georgia officials to reverse the election outcome, and objections to the certified vote by many Republicans in Congress are dividing the party. VOA's Steve Reddish looks at the impact.
Madam Speaker, members of Congress, pursuant to the Constitution and the laws of the United States.
Objections by congressional Republicans to the constitutionally required ceremony of counting the electoral votes, certifying that Democrat Joe Biden won the 2020 presidential election, were expected. But a riot by supporters of President Donald Trump and his unfounded claims that the election was fraudulent broke open the growing cracks in Trump's Republican wall of support. Chris Edelson is a professor at the School of Public Affairs at American University.
The Republican Party, unfortunately, has become really a cult of personality. And as I say, to be a Republican means to support President Trump no matter what.
But tireless loyalty from Vice President Mike Pence ended Wednesday, telling supporters what he told Trump the day before. He has no power to subvert the election results. Trump kept up the pressure on Pence during a rally near the White House hours before the count began.
All Vice President Pence has to do is send it back to the states to recertify, and we become president, and you are the happiest people.
Before the mob breached the Capitol, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell warned his colleagues of the political peril they faced by objecting.
The Constitution gives us here in Congress a limited role. The voters, the courts, and the states have all spoken. They've all spoken. If we overrule them, it would damage our republic forever.
Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri was the first to sponsor an objection to the electoral vote count. After the rioters were dispersed and order restored in the Senate, Hawley remained undeterred, even as the rioting had tightened the resolve of Democrats and some Republicans to approve Biden's win.
To those who say that this is just a formality today, an antique ceremony that we've engaged in for a couple of hundred years, I can't say that I agree. The opportunity to be heard, to register objections, is very vital because this is the place where those objections are to be heard and dealt with, debated, and finally resolved.
Senator Mitt Romney, the Republican nominee for president in 2012, took the young senator and others to task for supporting Trump's unfounded claims of election fraud.
No congressional audit is ever going to convince these voters, particularly when the president will continue to say that the election was stolen. The best way we can show respect for the voters who are upset is by telling them the truth. That's the burden. That's the duty of leadership. The truth is that President-elect Biden won the election. President Trump lost. I've had that experience myself. It's no fun.
And in the waning days of his single term, Trump faces the possibility of a second impeachment vote, which may force members of his own party to make a stand one way or another. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The unrest and violence in Washington sent a shockwave throughout the country, where American voters continue to grapple with the assault on the U.S. Capitol and what it means for the country moving forward. VOA's Kane Faribault has more from the Midwest state of Illinois.
Scrolling through news websites on his home office computer, Kent Redfield, a former Illinois state government employee and retired professor, couldn't believe what he was watching unfold at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
This was an attack on the legitimacy and authority of government and the rule of law. And so it was just stunning. It really was disbelief, and they're very difficult to get your head around.
Amid heightened security, activity at the Illinois State Capitol building in Springfield, where Redfield once worked, was noticeably quiet in the days following the riot at the U.S. Capitol. The implications of the attack increased Redfield's anxiety.
A really serious terrorist attack could have crippled the United States government. When those sorts of things started to sink in, and the pictures of the representatives sheltering in the galleries and stuff, the gravity of it started to hit you.
Kirkwood, Illinois farmer Wendell Shaman watched the lawlessness at the U.S. Capitol unfold on his living room television.
I don't think we know the full story yet. Whether this was all Trump supporters that really stirred this up or whether it was somebody else that took advantage of the opportunity to really raise havoc, raise hell, I don't know. I think that time will tell on that, hopefully.
Recent events and President Donald Trump's role in them, including his rejection of the presidential election results, have Shaman reevaluating his support for the man he voted for in 2016 and 2020.
It's certainly gone down. You can't discount what he did over the 4 years. I think the country, for the large part, is better off for it. He did not leave gracefully.
It must admit, I would worry that we're coming to the end of what I'll call democratic principles that we've understood and taken for granted for most of my life.
Longtime Illinois bookseller John Paul has a deep appreciation for history. His bookstore, Prairie Archives, is near the old Capitol building in Springfield, where in 1858, former President Abraham Lincoln delivered his famous House Divided speech. The address explored America's deep division over the wrongs of slavery ahead of the U.S. Civil War. John Paul believes Lincoln would mourn the current political divide in a union so many gave their lives to preserve.
Well, I'm reasonably convinced that he would be extremely shocked. Throughout the entire political history of the United States, we've never had issues that were like this. So,
Paul hopes a sense of national unity can be rekindled by President-elect Joe Biden, who appeared in front of Paul's bookshop when then-presidential candidate Barack Obama introduced him as his running mate in 2008. Paul says much has changed during the 12 years since, and he worries about damage done to the credibility of the U.S. election process and whether Biden can effectively govern a politically fractured nation.
The extreme right wing is going to reject any sense that Biden is a legitimate president, and this is just going to make his job much more difficult in trying to convince the public that he is and that he's trying to work on their behalf. All we can hope for is that it doesn't stay the same way that it is.
Paul's hopes will be put to the test beginning January 20th, when Trump departs the White House and Biden takes the oath of office to become president. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Springfield, Illinois.
Search and rescue operations continue for the Shrewa Gyra Air 737-500 that crashed with 62 aboard on Saturday. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda has the details.
Authorities in Indonesia have now located the black boxes from the Boeing 737 airliner that crashed into the sea on Saturday and hope the devices will provide some answers. There have been no clues yet to what brought down the Sriwijaya Air passenger jet with 62 people aboard, and search and rescue efforts are ongoing. Some victims' remains have been found. For relatives of those aboard, heartbreak. Family members are providing DNA samples to help identify their loved ones. Rafiq Yusuf Al-Idris had his wife on the plane.
The last time she contacted me was 2:05 p.m. She was still laughing on WhatsApp, saying she'd already boarded the plane and was told the weather condition isn't good. Then I said, yes, pray a lot, please.
It was raining when the plane took off shortly after 2:30 for a short trip to a neighboring island. The plane was a 27-year-old 737-500 model, which is much older than Boeing's controversial 737 MAX, although it's widely flown and doesn't share the same equipment implicated in the MAX's safety crisis. Sriwijaya Air also has a solid safety record. However, Indonesia has a troubled history with air safety. In 2007, the European Union banned all Indonesian airlines after a series of crashes and other safety problems in the 1990s. The ban wasn't fully lifted until 2018. That was the same year of the Lion Air disaster, in which a 737 MAX operated by a different Indonesian airline plunged into the sea, killing everyone aboard.
Reuters reporter Matthew LaRotonda. The scene in Britain is depressingly familiar. Stay-at-home orders, empty streets, hospitals overflowing, a daily toll of hundreds of coronavirus deaths as the United Kingdom becomes the epicenter of Europe's COVID-19 outbreak once again. And Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative government is under fire. AP correspondent Karen Chalmers has more.
More than 3 million people in the UK have tested positive for the coronavirus and 81,000 have died. 30,000 in just the last 30 days. UK opposition Labour Party leader Keir Starmer believes this is down to the British government's bad communication.
We've had 9 months of mixed messages from the government. It's really important now that that message is out there.
Even with the new lockdown, the medical director of primary care for NHS England, Dr. Nikki Kanani, says the virus is surging throughout Britain.
We could be looking at one in 30 people carrying the new variant of COVID, and often people are not symptomatic as well.
Kanani also pointed out that medical staff are at breaking point.
This has been going on for the best part of a year now, and people are exhausted.
Karen Chamas, London.
VOA has additional coronavirus coverage on our website. And finally, every year since 1997, the Prins Claus Fund, named in honor of Prince Claus of the Netherlands, presents a handful of international awards to honor individuals and organizations for their excellent, groundbreaking work in culture and development. The 2020 Principal Laureate awarded in December is Ghanaian visual artist Ibrahim Mahama. Music Time in Africa host Heather Maxwell takes us inside his studio to meet the artist and discover his art.
Hello, Ibrahim.
Hello.
First of all, congratulations on your recent award with as Principal Prince Claus Laureate. How does that feel?
Oh, well, it feels very good for this recognition, because when I started building this institution 5 years ago, I wasn't actually thinking about all of this. I was just thinking about creating a space that could allow for art to flourish within the community. So I'm really glad that at least people recognize this beyond this space.
Ibrahim Mahama is awarded for his exceptional artworks and for his social activism, raising awareness and urging us to take responsibility for improving the lives of others.
Tell us about the space you have there in Tamale.
We have actually three spaces at the moment. So the first space, which is SCCA Tamale. SCCA literally stands for Savannah Center for Contemporary Arts. It started in 2014 when I started earning money professionally as an artist. So in 2019, we opened the first exhibition there, which was a retrospective of an 80-year-old Ghanaian artist. And the second space is Red Clay, which is literally my studio, but it's an extension of SCCA, which also allows for the exhibitions to be extended here. We have spaces for archives, we have spaces for classrooms, we even have a parliament, which I designed, and a couple of other spaces.
So in what ways are you engaging the community?
The exhibitions that we produce, we produce a lot of workshops and programs around them. So for instance, at SCCA, we invite schools through the education department to come for workshops. At Red Clay, we recently did a series of workshops which actually involved inviting these women from the upper northern parts of Ghana who are known for painting and making these murals on buildings. So they came and worked with the artists whom we're doing the retrospective on to do this mural around the institution. And later also, we work with local audiences, working with them on how to produce pigments out of local materials. So we engage the community as much as we can in many different ways.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the first time you made money as an artist. So how was it that you made money as an artist the first time?
Well, it was a show which was at the Saatchi Gallery in London, and the institution was acquiring the piece. So when the piece was acquired, the money which I got from the piece was actually the money that I used as seed money to invest in building the first part of the institution. So that was in 2014.
What was that piece?
It was one of the early jute sack installations. So it was this piece which actually wrapped an entire room, and it was literally made up of these cocoa sacks which are used to transport cocoa and later on used to transport charcoal. So I mostly collect the material when they are very much used and like torn and tattered. So I exchanged the old bags with the new bags, and with the old bags, I sewed them together with a network of collaborators,
And then we go around the city and the country and we cover these monumental spaces with them. So in London, it was actually covering like the walls of an interior part of a gallery.
Back to the Prince Claus Award real quick. They mentioned that, you know, in general, art and culture is special because it speaks truth. What kind of truth are you saying in these pieces using sacks and, you know, stuff that normally people do not view as beautiful?
In my work, I address the contradiction of capital and also how labor is constantly being exploited. And the jute sacks are used in carrying like commodities like cocoa across, like from Africa to the rest of the world, which generates a lot of money. At the end of the day, a lot of that money is used then now to fund all kinds of programs. So I was very much interested in somehow using the leftover of the material as a point to be able to make art that somehow allows us to be able to re-examine the material in sense, in terms of its beauty and its ugliness. And the revenue that is generated out of it, because once the material goes into the realm of art, the value changes. So then the value that it translates into, which becomes like a new form of money, is what I then now use in building institutions like this, which also plays a different role within the society, which allows maybe children to be able to have access to art in a different way that probably I didn't have as a child growing up.
Ibrahim, thank you very much, and congratulations once again for your award, and best of luck in the future.
Thank you.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a magnificent Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Even for the ruthless Iranian regime, the abduction and execution of dissident journalist Ruhollah Zam were noteworthy for their viciousness and flagrant disregard for international norms. Iran hanged the founder of the popular anti-regime website Emet News on December 12th, just days after an Iranian court upheld the death sentence he was given for the so-called crime of spreading corruption on Earth. But Mr. Zam's real crime in the eyes of Iran's authority was challenging their rule and exposing their hypocrisy. Living in exile as an asylee in France, Mr. Zam was reportedly abducted by the IRGC and brought back into Iran in 2019. He was put on trial in February 2020. He was accused of inciting the anti-government demonstrations that broke out in 2017, and his forced confession was broadcast on television. He was convicted in June. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo strongly condemned Mr. Zam's execution, calling it unjust and barbaric. In a tweet, he noted that Zam exposed the brutality and corruption of the regime, which has killed or arrested more than 860 journalists in its 41-year reign of terror. Mr. Pompeo added, "The Iranian people deserve a free and diverse media, not censorship, arrests, and the execution of journalists." The international community also expressed outrage over the killing of Ruhollah Zam. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet said she was appalled by the execution. She said Zam's case was emblematic of a pattern of forced confessions extracted under torture and broadcast on state media being used as a basis to convict people. Sharif Mansour of the Committee to Protect Journalists described his death as monstrous and shameful. In a statement, the French Foreign Ministry called his execution barbaric and unacceptable, and France joined Germany, Austria, and Italy in canceling its participation in the Europe-Iran Business Forum, which was to be held December 14th. U.S. Special Envoy for Iran and Venezuela, Elliot Abrams, pointed out that Zam's execution followed the execution of champion Iranian wrestler Navid Afkari in September. It is another reminder that we are dealing with a brutal and radical regime that does not hesitate to defy international law and norms to assert power and control, Mr. Abrams said. That is why it is so crucial that the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism never acquire the world's most deadly weapon.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.